In France, more violence in the streets, more police sent out, and more frustration.
Every 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you have massive uprisings in the same locations based on the same stories.
Also ahead, Quebec's forests are still on fire. Many Americans can feel and smell the smoke that's drifting south. Canada's timber operators are also feeling the pinch. Huge tracts of forests are off limits to workers.
Well, they cannot harvest, they cannot do forest operations because the risk of fire is too high.
I'm Carol Hills. Plus, what makes a word funny? Some psycholinguists are trying to figure that out.
We were really the first people who seriously tried to predict what people were going to find funny and succeeded. And of course, we only succeeded because we were looking at the world's worst jokes.
Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. French President Emmanuel Macron is urging parents to keep their teenagers at home. Since Tuesday night, street protesters have been burning vehicles and buildings and engaging in other acts of violence. The anger erupted after the fatal police shooting of a 17-year-old French citizen of North African descent. In response, tens of thousands of police have been deployed, armed and prepared to subdue and arrest the demonstrators. Mabula Somahoro has been watching all this. She's a professor at the University of Tours in France and also the founder of French Black History Month. She joins us from Paris. Mabula, what was your first thought when you saw the news about the killing of the teenager we now know as Nahel M?
The first thought was shock and exhaustion. It's a story we've heard before. All the ingredients are the same. It's exactly the same recipe. And it simply makes you feel like nothing is, making progress, even though I need to nuance that because the charges that have been held against the police officer involved in that shooting are, I think, unprecedented. So that's the progress. But for you to think about how much needs to be done to get just to the level of normal is really what causes exhaustion.
You mentioned it had all the ingredients of a particular recipe. Mm-hmm. What are those ingredients?
Young men, young non-white men, in this case, probably North African or Muslim, based on the name. The territory, the suburb, Nanterre, outside of Paris, some type of racial profiling or, what the police call, routine checks, and then everything that follows. Who was this young man? And he was, kind of criminalized. It's always the case. He refused the identity check. The police had the right to shoot, and he's dead, and that's not the police fault.
Now, the outpouring of anger about this death, it's about much more than just one death.
Mm-hmm.
How do racial tensions and economic disparities play into what we're seeing?
I think that this, everything that you've mentioned has to do with the territory. And when we're talking about the territory of the suburb, we're talking about the underprivileged neighborhoods. Those territories are oftentimes more policed than other places. We have, schools, people failing at school, education, mass incarceration, all these things that has to do with the territory because these are the cheaper territories where people can inhabit even though they don't make a lot of money. This is how the socioeconomic situation unfolds along racial and ethnic lines. So even though France talks about, this ideal of universalism and this upholding of colorblindness, there is a strong intersection of class, race, ethnicity within France, whether the country accepts it or not.
Now, tens of thousands of armed police are out in the streets.
Yes.
They're armed to the teeth.
Yes.
Is the response to the killing of this teenager, how do you see the response of fanning out this level of police?
I think that the response is part of the repetition that I spoke about initially. It's the same thing every time there's a case of, police brutality, somebody dies, and then you have lots of police on the streets, and that's the response. So every 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you have massive uprisings in the same locations based on the same stories. And that's been a repeated narrative since, at least 40 years. We oftentimes talk about, because today, this year is 2023, And it marks the 40th anniversary of the 1983 march that was called for March for Justice and Against Racism. And that march that crossed France from Marseille, metropolitan France, from Marseille all the way to Paris, people marched. And that gathered 200,000 people in Paris in December of 1983. That was exactly the same story. Police brutality, people protesting, and, you know, lots of police on the streets. So how many times do we need to understand that this is not the way? I mean, we can buy time if we think of 2005, which were the latest massive, you know, uprisings in hexagonal France. That was back in 2005. So it's not even 20 years ago. It's only 18 years ago. After 2005, you had unrest in 2007 following the death of two teenagers. So to me, it's so clear. It's so crystal clear, the same story and the same methods. So either we are interested as a nation in finding solutions, or we're just handling the moment, and then we're just holding our breath until the next massive unrest.
What are people in the streets calling for? At this point, are they venting anger and bringing attention to the problems in French society, or are they asking for anything specific?
They're calling for justice. There needs to be a trial. That's all. They're calling for justice.
Here in the U.S., the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, it opened up a national conversation on race. How do people discuss race and ethnicity in France?
Wow. So I would say that what happened 3 years ago with George Floyd reopened a conversation that had been going on in the States since, you know, I don't know, at least the 19th century or even during the times of slavery, right? So, you know, Black Lives Matter and George Floyd and 2020, it was just a reiteration of what had happened before. In France, the situation is different because the country still feels that race is not a valid category, that race does not exist, that France is a, you know, colorblind universalist republic, which makes it very difficult to have those conversations. But it's becoming less and less possible to, you know, avoid this issue. You know, people can say and talk about this event saying a young man from Nanterre was killed. And if you say, you know, this young man happened to be of North African origin, and you will find a lot of people saying it doesn't matter.
The well-known motto of France is liberté, égalité, fraternité, liberty, equality, fraternity. How do people there reconcile that with institutional racism in their country?
They don't believe in institutional racism. So that's the thing. So there's nothing to reconcile. But we are, you know, the people who are critical towards all of this are saying the national motto is beautiful. We've just never seen it in existence. It's theory, and it's the age-old gap between theory and practice. In theory, it's great. In practice, we've never seen it. Never.
Mabula Soumahoro is a professor at the University of Tours in France. She's been talking to us about the killing of a French teenager of North African descent and the violence that's followed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Carol.
A week ago, it looked like Russia was on the precipice of a seismic shift and the Kremlin appeared under threat. Mercenaries from the Wagner private military company were seizing a major Russian city and about to begin a march towards Moscow. Just as suddenly, the next day, the Wagner fighters stopped their advance, and the short-lived uprising was called off. The immediate danger to Russian President Vladimir Putin now seems to have passed, but questions about his leadership linger. The World's Daniel Offman reports on some of the after effects of the Wagner mutiny.
In the early hours of the mutiny, Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of Wagner, posted a message on social media. He said, "The evil perpetrated by the country's military leadership must be stopped." To be clear, Prigozhin was not speaking out against the war in Ukraine. However, he claimed that Russia's military leaders were incompetent, were failing the war effort, and were trying to get rid of him. In the hours that followed, high-ranking Russian generals spoke out against the Wagner mutiny.
Я призываю остановиться. Противник только ждет,
In this video, Russian General Sergei Saravikin called on Wagner to stop what they were doing. He said, "We can't play into the hands of our enemies in this difficult moment." Here's Andrei Soldatov. He's a London-based investigative reporter who specializes on Russian security services.
These two men, they've known each other for a long period of time. The paths of Saravikin and Wagner crossed in several regions, not only in Ukraine.
Soldatov says that because of his close ties with Prigozhin, Saravikin played a key role in managing the relationship between Wagner and the Kremlin.
Saravikin was assigned to be a sort of go-between Wagner and the Russian army. His official position was to help Wagner to get ammunition for fighting in Bakhmut.
Saravikin speaking out against Wagner meant that the Kremlin had lost its patience. Later, Vladimir Putin doubled down.
Все, кто сознательно встал на путь предательства, кто готовил вооруженный мятеж, встал на путь.
Путин said that anyone involved in this betrayal will be punished. Soldatov says that Putin's message was aimed at Wagner, but perhaps more importantly, at his own armed forces.
Basically, his message was, look, now I believe that Prigozhin is a traitor. You cannot support a traitor. After that, it was just a matter of time when Prigozhin would give up because he didn't get any support from the military.
And that's exactly what happened. The Wagner fighters stopped their march on Moscow, and no Russian troops dared to support Prigozhin. Yet many questions remain unanswered, like what will happen with Wagner?
There's so much intrigue going on at this exact moment. It's like, it really is like the Game of Thrones.
That's Dara Masico. She's a senior policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, where she studies the Russian military. She says that President Putin had signaled that Wagner's days as a fighting force in Ukraine were over.
We know that they're dismantling Wagner. Like, that's pretty clear. They're not going to be a player in Ukraine in terms of being a heavily armed force. That's no longer acceptable. They're stripping them of their heavy equipment.
On top of Wagner losing its standing as a reliable fighting force in Ukraine, there's also a lot of speculation about the state of Russia's military leadership.
The leadership of the military, Sergei Shoigu, who's the Minister of Defense, and Chief of General Staff Gerasimov, disappeared from public view during this event. In the moment where they should have been visible, they were gone.
Their absence was especially significant since the goal of Prigozhin's mutiny was to remove them from their jobs. Masco says that even before the events of last week, Gerasimov wasn't seen as a particularly popular figure in the military.
He has not been an effective wartime leader in Ukraine. And I have not ever seen in the last 16 months or more any real enthusiasm for him among the military.
Prigozhin's insurrection has led to speculation that perhaps there will be a shakeup among the Russian military command. As of now, though, Masico is skeptical that Putin will make any big changes.
Maybe they just try to cover this up, pin the blame on Prigozhin, and say everything else is fine. We conducted an investigation and we found that it was just Prigozhin. Let's all go back to business. That's probably the quickest and easiest pathway back to the status quo. And Putin is signaling that he desperately wants to return back to the status quo.
In recent days, there have been reports that General Saravikin was detained and brought in for questioning by Russian officials. However, it's unclear if he's under investigation. For now, Putin is doing all he can to maintain the image of stability and control and hold on to the status quo. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
Ever hear a word that just makes you chuckle?
I just think the word gazebo doesn't feel English, and what it's used to describe is so specific and dumb.
Scientists looked into what makes a word funny. We'll tell you what they found. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. People across the Midwest got a reminder this week. Canada is on fire. Nearly every province is burning, and firefighters are overwhelmed. The drifting smoke may be the most obvious downside to residents of the U.S., but Canada's worst fire season on record also means lost timber and livelihoods up north. The World's Anna Kusmer reports.
There's a NASA website that has a live map of North America. Every place where there's an active fire, a little icon glows orange. Right now, nearly all of Canada is covered in orange. Jan Boulanger is a forest ecologist at Natural Resources Canada.
So at a national scale, we're currently at 7.8 million hectares, probably close to 8 million. So it roughly corresponds to the size of Czech Republic.
It's a record year, and it's only June. Hit especially hard is the boreal forest in northern Quebec.
We have accumulated more area burns during the last 30 days than within the last 20 years combined.
Almost 1,200 people from Cree communities across the northern part of the province have fled their homes due to wildfires.
The fires have displaced more than 11,000 people over the last month, disproportionately impacting First Nations communities who live further north.
I think it's fair to say that for Quebec, it's probably the worst it has been in my 35 years of as a forest engineer, forester in Quebec.
Benoit Côté teaches at McGill University in Montreal. Around half of the burning forest is used for logging.
If it's going to continue like this, that would be, I would say, catastrophic for the forest industry. And we're talking about a million hectares of forest that went in smoke.
Around the size of Connecticut. And the impact is already being felt. Huge swaths of Quebec are off limits to forest workers during what would normally be a busy time of year.
Companies are not allowed to work right now. So they cannot harvest, they cannot do forest operations because the risk of fire is too high.
Forestry in the province supports tens of thousands of jobs. With less supply of timber, markets are already pointing to higher prices in the near future. In Quebec, most of the commercial forests are full of spruce, pine, and fir. Côté says when a hot fire burns through, it mostly burns the foliage, leaving the trunks standing. And companies will race to try to harvest that.
So now they're saying to the government, we have to get our act together and give us the permit to go and harvest the burned forest. Okay, so that would be a way to soften the blow at the end of the year.
The hot, dry conditions that created this fire weather are hallmarks of global warming. Conditions Côté says Quebec foresters weren't expecting this soon.
It's a reality check for us here in Quebec. So we'll see how we're going to react and if we're going to change anything to the way we do forest management.
Much of the burned areas will be replanted by forestry companies. Côté says bringing more tree diversity into the new forests can help the industry adapt to fires in a climate change future.
Having spruce everywhere in northern Quebec may not be the best scenario for the future.
Firefighters have come to Canada from around the world to help save communities and commercial forests. Around half the fires raging in Quebec are in wilderness areas north of the logging forests. Unless there's a community nearby, these forests are being left to burn, which means until the fires go out naturally, anyone downwind will continue to breathe them in. For The World, I'm Anna Cusmer.
What makes a word funny? Most of us have a favorite word or two that makes us laugh. For me, it's offspring and gubernatorial. Yours may be skedaddle or flummoxed or simply poop. But why do we find them funny? The sound, the meaning, or some combination of the two? Patrick Cox reports on what some comedians think and what a team of researchers discovered.
You may not find the word peanut especially funny, but what about this?
Kikiriki.
It's peanut in Serbian. And it sounds, well, funny. More than the English version, anyway. But why? Serbian-Canadian comedian Filip Jeremic thinks it's because of all those Ks.
It's very phonetic. It's K-I-K-I-R-I-K-I. Kikiriki.
Comedians have long believed that they get laughs from words rich in Ks. Neil Simon referenced it in his play The Sunshine Boys. It's about the craft of comedy and was made into a 1975 movie with Walter Matthau and Richard Benjamin.
You know which words are funny and which words are not funny?
You told me 100 times, Uncle Willie. Listen, I have
which
to get to the office.
Which words are funny?
Words with a K in it are funny.
Pickle is funny, the Matthau character says. So is chicken and cupcake. But is it really just the K sound that we're responding to? Or is there a bit more to it? Chris Westbury heads a team of psycholinguists at the University of Alberta who've been trying to figure this out.
We were really the first people who seriously tried to predict what people were going to find funny and succeeded. And of course, we only succeeded because we were looking at the world's worst jokes.
Westbury's research didn't actually start with jokes, just an invented word, or a non-word, as he calls it.
Now, non-word was snunkuple.
With a non-word like that, in other words, one that has no meaning, you're reacting purely to the sound. And this particular sound, snunkuple, it makes people chuckle. Westbury discovered this while working on a study that had nothing to do with humor. His team was looking at aphasia, a form of brain damage that affects people's ability to process language. They asked participants to look at non-words among a sea of random letters on a screen. When Snunkupel came up, everyone laughed.
All of the non words were made up by computer. We didn't have anything to do with it. So we didn't choose that word because it was funny. But the interesting thing is we thought it was funny too, and most people do.
Westbury and his team decided to figure out why. They analyzed their computer-generated non-words and determined that when the letter combinations of the non-words were incongruous, they made people laugh.
The more incongruous it is, the weirder the word is, the funnier people find it, with some constraints. If you make a really stupid word that has like no vowels in it or something, people don't find it funny. But if you make a reasonable word that's made up of unusual letters and sounds, the more unusual the letters and sounds are, the funnier people find it.
The theory that incongruous non-words make you laugh works with real words, too.
I just think the word gazebo doesn't feel English, and what it's used to describe is so specific and dumb.
This is Venezuelan-American comedian Joanna Houseman on one of her favorite funny words.
I think I've said gazebo maybe once in context, and it was at my like rich friend's house in Connecticut, because who else has a gazebo?
In this case, it's not just the sound that makes Houseman smile, but the gulf between the sound and its concrete meaning. Chris Westbury's research into what makes words funny is expanding. He confirms that K is indeed inherently funny, and he's finding more letter combinations that bring out the giggles.
Words that have certain phonemes in them are also funny. And it happens that both PLE words, words that end in PLE, in fact, any consonant LE, and words that have OO in them are judged funnier.
And what word includes PLE as well as OO and K? Snunkupel. Now, it just needs a definition. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
More news and stories from around the globe are still ahead. You're listening to The World. Tijuana, Mexico is crazy for Little League Baseball. The city has more than 100 teams. Their rosters include kids who live north of the border.
We have a lot of people that cross the border every day just to come and play because they know the level that we play over here in the league is it's awesome.
The Tijuana All-Stars play in Mexico's national tournament this weekend. A look at baseball's future stars ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been more than a decade since the start of Syria's uprising and civil war. More than 130,000 people have disappeared in that war. Now the UN is establishing an independent body to investigate the status of those who are still missing. Syrian activist Wafa Ali Mustafa has been working to resolve one of those cases, her own father. She joins us now from Berlin. Wafa, what's your reaction to the UN setting up an independent body to clarify the status of missing people in Syria?
I had mixed feelings, I would say. I was definitely very glad and very grateful for the efforts of the families of detainees, the survivors, the victims I know, and the people who have been, you know, fighting and advocating for years for this institution to be established. Finally, you know, after 12 years, the UN managed to do anything that is, you know, a real step and to provide an action finally regarding Syria and regarding Syria's disappeared. But this decision will take years to turn into, you know, an actual institution that can actually investigate and reveal the fate of people.
This is very hard and very personal for you. Can you tell us about your father's disappearance in July 2013?
Yeah, I mean the timing is, I don't know, it's crazy. I mean, just in 2 days, my father will complete a whole decade. It's heartbreaking for me to say, you know, to even pronounce these words. It's just, you know, a whole decade of uncertainty, of pain, of, you know, of endless efforts to just, you know, to try to know what happened to him.
What were the circumstances of your own father's disappearance in July 2013?
My father was in our family house in Damascus, and my mom was on her way to visit him. You know, we just left them alone because we thought that, you know, they've been separated for a while. They need to, you know, spend some time together. And, you know, my mom, you know, cooked my dad's favorite food. She even bought him new clothes. And, you know, we were making fun of them. My sisters and I were like, oh, they're having a new honeymoon and all of that. And we were happy for them that they will meet, you know, they will get to spend some time together. And my mom was on her way to Damascus from our hometown, Masyaf. And she called my dad 15 minutes before she arrived. And yeah, she just, you know, told him that he needs to come downstairs to help her because she wrote many things. And, you know, they laughed together and he told her that, you know, everything is perfect. He's cleaned the house and he's just waiting for her. In 15 minutes, my mom arrived, and I mean, unfortunately, she called my father and he never responded till today.
What have you been doing since then to try to find him or at least figure out what has happened to him?
I've been trying to do everything you can imagine. You know, within Syria, we've tried, you know, bribes, we've tried connections, we've assigned not one, many, many lawyers, and we got nothing out of that. And you know, I've been advocating on all levels. I mean, I've been going to the streets. I've been, you know, holding protests, demonstrations. I've been talking to different, you know, to politicians, to policymakers. I addressed the UN Security Council. I addressed the UN General Assembly. And just, you know, advocating for, you know, for a real solution, a real end to the crime of detention and enforced disappearance in Syria. And unfortunately, nothing, you know, nothing has changed.
The families of the missing, and that means you and your family, are to be represented in this new UN body. Why is that so critical?
This is crucial. This is important. Unfortunately, today we look at it as a huge thing, although I truly believe this should have been the norm years and years ago. But it finally happened. And I think it's important because it also says, again, that detention, enforced disappearances, and torture are systematic and widespread, and that they are used by the Assad regime to silence and to break a movement that demanded freedom and dignity for Syria.
Wafa Ali Mustafa is a Syrian activist and journalist. Her father disappeared in Syria in 2013. She's been speaking to us from Berlin. Thank you very much, Wafa.
Thank you.
Modern warfare is not just fought on land and sea. A new and active front is cyberspace. Think of computer hackers bringing down an electrical grid, for example. The U.S. Army has special cyber teams that help friendly countries fend off attackers. In the winter of 2021, as Russian troops massed on the Ukraine border, American operatives deployed to Kyiv. They arrived in the country with their so-called hunt kits, powerful computer servers carried in suitcases small enough to fit in overhead compartments. Dina Temple-Raston of the Click Here podcast was granted exclusive access to the people who went to Ukraine to hunt down Russian malware.
When U.S. cyber teams deploy overseas to look for bad guys in foreign networks, it usually takes months to work out the details with their foreign partners. But when it came to helping Ukraine, there just wasn't that kind of time.
That process was condensed into about 30 days in this case.
This is Ryan. He's a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army and the deputy commander of a joint task force that specializes in hunting Russian cyber activity. Ryan was one of a half dozen cyber operatives we spoke to who deployed to Ukraine before the war. This is the first time they're speaking publicly about the mission. We're only using their first names to protect their identities.
You're looking at the summer exercises. Back in 2021, the Russians are amassed on the border. We realized that this was probably a place where we needed to be.
In other words, Russian cyber operators had probably already found systems to compromise. They were probably already hiding in key networks. So in mid-December 2021, just a few months before the Russians would invade, Ryan and other American cyber operatives got onto planes and flew to Ukraine. They landed in Kyiv, rolling heavy black suitcases filled with hunt kits, and they were greeted by a team of Ukrainian cyber operatives who would become their partners in the mission.
Right, so it's like a LAN party. We're all just kind of in there getting our system set up.
A LAN party, as in local area network. Back in the 90s, when broadband internet was expensive and hard to get, people used to gather in some big physical space, connect their computers and consoles to the same network, and then play video games. The hunt team operations room was like that.
Big table, lots of computers, switches in the middle.
A mass of boxes and wires.
Putting the network devices someplace where someone's not going to step on them. Trying to figure out who pairs up with their counterpart. And then putting really, you know, that paper plan into action.
to figure out the pattern and practice of the Russians, they had to think like them. If we were them, what would we target? And they started brainstorming with the Ukrainians.
Military functions, like command and control, for instance, or communications. You look at civil infrastructure, things like power, things like water, bridges, dams, and the like.
Most of those tools of conventional warfare and even civilian infrastructure are connected to the internet these days. So the potential attack surface is endless. Everything's vulnerable.
So understanding that this could happen, we realized that if they're working on these things, they're probably working on them now. And we need to get into a position where we can witness this, observe it, and do something about it.
And the truth of the matter is, Ukraine has been going toe-to-toe with Russian adversaries in cyberspace for years. Russia has targeted their electrical grid, blanketed them with misinformation. And that meant that, by necessity, Ukraine had built one of the more sophisticated network defenses in Europe. American hunt teams had deployed there three times before, and they had worked with Ukraine and put a lot of safeguards in, but nothing is foolproof. Ukraine declined to talk to us for this story.
So from a technical sense, you know, if I'm a hacker, I'm looking for places where I can find a window or a door to break into. I'm looking for vulnerable services. I'm looking for places to hide in a way that looked normal, wouldn't tip the average admin looking at that network on a daily basis.
When I flew over there, there were about 20 of us that flew over initially.
Sharon was the team lead of the Hunt Forward operation in Ukraine. She's a major in the U.S. Marine Corps. And her team that started at 20 people quickly grew to more than 40. That's because of the cyber attack that they'd all been bracing for. It arrived early one morning in January 2022.
Ukrainian government has fallen prey to malware cyber attack.
In mid-January, I had woke up one morning. We were about to continue the hunt missions as normal for the day and checked my phone and had immediately received, you know, all of these articles and information from our local partners.
It looked like ransomware, announced with a message that said, "Ukrainians, all information about you is public. Be afraid and expect worse. It's your past, present, and future." The foreign ministry was hit, the cabinet of ministers, and the Security and Defense Council. The ransomware appeared to be inside Ukrainian government networks.
Our partners asked us, "Can you please conduct any type of analysis you can on different drives, different systems that have been impacted by these cyber attacks?" And so that's what we did. We stood up.
Within hours, Ukrainians were handing over physical hard drives, logs, files, and the HFO began pulling together a team to study them.
Because we had established that trust and just began to dig into them to understand the attacks a little bit more.
And one of the people asked to dig into them was this guy. Could you introduce yourself to me, please?
Of course. I'm Patrick. I was one of the youngest people that went on the mission. When I was there, I was actually only 20, so not even old enough to drink back here in the States. This is my first deployment. Very nervous going into it, so I'm glad everything went well, I suppose.
Patrick is sitting across from me at an unclassified facility in rural Maryland. But we aren't alone. There's a crowd of people there, mostly to make sure Patrick doesn't tell me anything classified. That's as much as I'm allowed to say about that. I can tell you Patrick is in the Navy, but nothing beyond that. He looks like a teenager, and he was the guy asked to analyze what the world now knows as Whispergate malware.
It was when we first got it. Very complex malware, I would say. The people who wrote it seemed to really know exactly what they were doing with this.
Patrick and his team went to work, and they had two options for trying to assess how much damage this new bit of sinister code had done and what it might do. The first, static analysis, is exactly what it sounds like.
Which is going through without running it and trying to determine if we can find anything that might flag on the malware or look particularly suspicious just inside the malware itself while it's not running.
Dynamic analysis, on the other hand?
Dynamic is actually taking that piece of malware and putting it into a safe, contained environment, in what we call detonating it or running it, to try to see exactly what it does. And then we record it.
The way you might have a controlled explosion of a bomb.
So it would pop up a little message on screen saying, "You can pay X amount to get your files back."
But when they analyzed it further,
it became obvious that there was no method for this to reverse the encryption it did. At the end of the day, you weren't getting your files back, period, and stop. It was designed to destroy them.
What they found was something called wiper malware, something that's built to look like ransomware, but actually it was something much worse. Wiper malware isn't about locking up files and waiting for a ransom to be paid to return your files. In this case, it was about pretending to be ransomware, just to buy time for the malware to do what it was really intended to do, wipe files and destroy networks. That's what they now realized was in the Ukrainian government systems. It became publicly known as Whispergate.
It was a very complex piece of malware. It had two stages that it went through. And this was my first time discovering something so complex in the wild.
So I think what's different about it is the scale in which it was used.
Okay. This is Major General Joe Hartman. He's the commander of the Cyber National Mission Force. General Hartman was nominated for his third star last month.
Mid-January, we saw literally dozens of wiper attacks. You know, we saw some attempt to obfuscate that it was, in fact, you know, a nation state executing a wiper attack by making it look like a ransomware attack.
The general said the use of wiper malware wasn't new, but he was convinced that Whispergate wasn't off the shelf. It was clearly created by the Russians with the Ukrainians in mind. It isn't just the local teams that get something out of the deployments. Depending on the agreement they have with a partner, hunt teams are sometimes able to bring samples of the malware they've helped capture and contain back home to the U.S. and study it, which is particularly useful because foreign adversaries will often try out malware on other countries before trying it out on the U.S.
If you remember, there were a lot of reports in the news at that point. You know, we were expecting potential Russian attacks in the United States, and so there was a sense of urgency on the Ukrainian side, and there was a sense of urgency on the U.S. side.
So these hunt forward operations give the U.S. a hint as to what the adversary is working on, what might be coming. And then they can alert tech companies about potential vulnerabilities and get those vulnerabilities patched. So offering allies this kind of help, Hartman says it helps the U.S. too.
Gaining access to malicious software in a foreign nation, sharing it with a private U.S. cybersecurity company that may have millions of endpoints is really beneficial to the defense of those things that we care about in the United States.
So in other words, if you catch it over there, it's before it has a chance to come over here, and that's why it's to Absolutely. Our advantage.
Absolutely.
Originally, the American hunt teams were supposed to be home for Christmas, but their departure just kept getting delayed as more and more Russian troops amassed at the border.
Walking around, you started to feel that people were realizing that the Russians could invade. I recall one time I was walking down the street, and I looked and I saw a piece of graffiti on the wall. I can't read Ukrainian, so I asked someone who was with us who knew how to read it what exactly it said.
Join your local militia, it read.
So that's kind of when it hit me, that there could be fighting here in a couple weeks.
And then, General Hartman said, the order to pull out finally came.
And that was, a fairly emotional order to, hey, it's time for everybody to leave the country.
Sharon and a gunnery sergeant were the last ones to leave. 72 hours later, all commercial flights leaving Ukraine were canceled. All told, General Hartman says the U.S. and Ukraine have shared over 6,000 indicators of compromise, those little granular artifacts that suggest that malicious cyber actors have been inside a network. There are things like irregular IP addresses or unusual activity. And Hartman, he says his teams are still watching.
Is it safe to assume that there are some teams deployed around places that are close to Russia and close to Ukraine?
So I've been in command almost 4 years, and it's safe to assume there are always teams deployed in the European theater of command.
In Europe and around the world. Though they have pulled out of Ukraine, Hartman said there are 6 to 10 teams deployed at any given moment, always on the hunt. For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Rust.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of the podcast Click Here. Additional reporting by Sean Powers, Will Jarvis, and Sarah Wyman. The Women's World Cup is now less than 3 weeks away. Soccer teams across the globe are finalizing their rosters. Spain announced their lineup today, with a number of stars noticeably missing. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show and is here to fill us in. Hey, Bianca.
Hi, Carol.
So what's happening with Spain's World Cup team, and why are some players not going to compete?
So this story really starts about 9 months ago in September, when 15 players on the Spanish women's national soccer team wrote emails to the Spanish Football Federation saying they were upset with the way that their head coach, Jorge Vilda, was managing the team.
Do we know what they're referring to specifically, what they're concerned about in terms of Jorge Vilda's behavior?
We don't know specifics, but they said there was a negative impact on their emotional and physical well-being. They didn't like the atmosphere that was created in the locker room, and things like training facilities and injury management weren't up to speed. So these 15 players said they would not play for the national team until a solution was found.
Okay, so what did the Spanish Football Federation say in response?
They put out this strongly worded statement that said the players were out of line and didn't have control over the coaching staff. And then they threatened the athletes with a multi-year ban and demanded they admit their error and apologize.
Wow, so they clearly sided with head coach Vilda. But like you said, that was 9 months ago. What has happened since to bring us to today? I mean, has anything been resolved?
This is where it gets a little bit unclear. The Spanish players who wrote the emails have really wanted their complaints to be dealt with privately and not played out in the press. So we don't know exactly what has or has not been resolved. But, Carol, three of those players are on the team's World Cup roster after all. One of them is Aitana Bonmatí, who told a Spanish news outlet that the process had been carried out internally and would remain that way. Whatever the process was, though, it clearly didn't satisfy most of the athletes because 12 of them stood their ground and refused to play. The Spanish Football Federation didn't reply to my request for comment about this, but in a recent press conference, head coach Vilda was repeatedly asked if the players' concerns had been addressed.
El cuerpo técnico siempre ha estado abierta al diálogo, siempre se ha mostrado en pos de solucionar este conflicto.
He said the coaching staff has always been open to dialogue with players and the situation is, quote, practically solved. And he reemphasized today that the team is united and is going to perform as well as possible down in Australia and New Zealand.
So, Bianca, what has the reaction been from the rest of the soccer world?
It's largely been in support of the players. I mean, women's soccer has seen major progress in the past few years, especially regarding equal and fair treatment, including in the U.S. But U.S. forward Alex Morgan recently said that Spain's situation shows there's clearly a long way to go.
You look at Spain and there's some players who should absolutely be in this World Cup that are not going to the World Cup due to the inequalities of their team and standing up for themselves and the future generations of their sport.
So now something many people wonder is how this whole situation will impact Spain's play on the field. And we'll get a look at that in their first World Cup match on July 21st against Costa Rica.
The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for us. She's been filling us in on why some key players in Spain are bowing out of this summer's Women's World Cup. Bianca, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Carol.
The Mexican border city of Tijuana has become a hotspot for young baseball talent. Its Little League All-Star team is heading to the Mexican National Tournament starting tomorrow. KPBS reporter Gustavo Solís has the story.
Tijuana Municipal is a local institution. This Little League has 144 teams, 1,800 players, a 9-acre complex filled with baseball diamonds and batting cages, even cross-training and sports psychologists. The league also has a proud history of producing Major League Baseball players.
I can name a lot. It's Adrian Gonzalez, Alejandro Kirk, Jonathan Aranda, Oscar Robles.
That's right. Padres legend Adrian Gonzalez played Little League right here in Tijuana. One of the fields is even named after him. Alberto Mejia is the league president. He says it's common for kids in San Diego to play baseball south of the border.
But you know what? We have a lot of people that cross the border every day just to come and play because they know the level that we play over here in the league. It's awesome.
This year's All-Star team features kids who have been playing together since they were 3 years old. The team dominated the regional tournament, allowing 0 runs and scoring 37 on their way to the championship.
The team behind us, they are a very good team. The coaches are super smart. They have a lot of experience.
If this team wins the national tournament in Monterrey, they'll represent Mexico in the Little League World Series. Francisco Fimbres is the coach. He also coached the 2013 Little League team that made it all the way to the semifinal game against Japan.
Sería lo máximo, sería muy bonito y por qué no buscar ahora sí lo que no se logró en el 2013, ¿no?
He says that returning to Williamsport would give Tijuana a second chance to win the World Series. Why does Tijuana produce so many good baseball players? Fimbres says that it's the local competition. There are almost 2,000 players in this league, and they all compete at a very high level.
La competencia interna, créeme que es muy fuerte, es muy buena.
He also says there aren't any star players on this team. No big egos. The players practically grew up together. Fimbres says they're more like brothers than teammates.
Se tratan como hermanos, la verdad, ellos están muy, muy bien acoplados.
And that's one message that the players have really bought into. Here's their response when asked who the best player on the team is.
Pues somos todos. Todos somos uno.
All of us, says Jonathan Juarez. We are all one unit. Another player, Jorge Cota, watches the Williamsport tournament every year on TV. He says actually getting to play in it would be pretty awesome.
Pues que estaría muy padre ir a jugar a Estados Unidos y pues en un torneo tan importante.
As in San Diego, Little League in Tijuana is a family affair. Parents travel with the team. They come prepared to cheer. They bring drums and have multiple chants and songs ready to go. This is one of their favorites.
Esta es la porra de Tijuana. Esta es la porra de Tijuana. Se mueve para allá, se mueve para acá. Esta es la porra de Tijuana.
Miriam González Pérez is one of the team moms. Seeing just how hard the kids train inspires the parents to put in just as much effort, if not more.
Vemos el esfuerzo que hacen los niños, y como ellos le echan ganas, nosotros tenemos que echarle el doble de ganas.
It's a sacrifice. Parents spend their entire weekends going to baseball tournaments, and traveling with the team isn't cheap. They set up a GoFundMe page to raise money to cover travel expenses. The national tournament starts July 1st. If they win that, Tijuana will represent Mexico in the Little League World Series this August.
Una, dos, tres.
Uno, tres, Tijuana!
For the world, I'm Gustavo Solís in Tijuana.
Good luck to the boys in Tijuana. And if you haven't had enough sports today, buy a ticket for Monday's show. The world is going all sports for the whole hour. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a groovy weekend.